Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In the first edition of a special three-part podcast series on newly approved bispecifics, Cancer Network's Gina Morrow spoke with Dr. Daniel Morgenstern, advanced practice provider Mary Ellen Flanagan, and clinical pharmacist Janelle Mann, all from Washington University in St. Louis. The discussion focused on the use of amivantamab for patients with EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer, which included a review of data from trials such as Chrysalis and Mariposa, as well as strategies for mitigating infusion-related reactions.
We're going to be talking in this series about newly approved agents in lung cancer and how to manage them. Dr. Morgenstern, would you like to kick us off and start discussing the first agent of interest for this series?
Thank you, Gina. The first drug that we'll talk about is called amivantamab. And what we're trying to do here is describe the drug, talk about some of the clinical results. Then we go on to review how the drug is administered. And finally, we'll talk about some of the toxicities and how to treat them. So amivantamab is a bispecific antibody targeting EGFR and MET. The mechanism of action is dependent on both the Fab and Fc regions. The Fab region, which is the tip of the antibody, binds to both EGFR and MET. And by doing it, it blocks the ligand-induced receptor activation. After that, the receptor is internalized and degraded in the lysosomes. The Fc portion, which is the tail of the antibody, is involved in immune-mediated activity, mostly when it binds to the Fc gamma 3A receptor, mostly on natural killer cells, leading to the so-called antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity, or ADCC. One of the interesting factors about this drug is that it has low fucosylation in the Fc domain, and that facilitates the ADCC. Another mechanism mediated by the Fc receptor or the C domain is what is called antibody-dependent cellular thrombocytosis. That's a very complicated name, but basically means that the macrophages, mostly also monocytes, they bite the receptor and have an intake of both the receptor and part of the cytoplasm. With all those factors, there's a decrease in the EGFR and MET receptors in the cells. So the first studies of amivantamab tested this drug as a single agent. Those are the Chrysalis studies. And after that, there were studies looking at the combination of amivantamab and lazertinib, which is a third-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And those studies were called Chrysalis 2. Those are multi-arm studies in different settings. The initial approval for amivantamab was in patients with EGFR exon 20 mutations, where the single-agent amivantamab showed impressive results in the cohort D of the Chrysalis study. In the subsequent study was the Papillon study, which shows the addition of amivantamab to standard chemotherapy improved the outcomes compared to chemotherapy alone in patients with exon 20 mutation treated in the first-line setting. With that, amivantamab was approved in the first-line in combination of chemotherapy in March 2024. But the most important, I think, is for patients that have the classical EGFR mutations, which are present in 80 to 90% of the patients. Those are the exon 19 deletions or L858R mutations. The combination of amivantamab and lazertinib, which are now called AmiLaser for facilitating my speaking skills, the response rate was encouraging from 21 to 39% in patients previously treated with osimertinib and chemotherapy. And the disease control was durable. So in the phase 3 study called Mariposa 2, the addition of amivantamab alone or in combination with lazertinib improved the outcomes, mostly response rate and progression-free survival compared to chemotherapy alone. That led to the approval of amivantamab in the second-line setting. And what everybody wanted to see was the first-line setting, where the combination of amivantamab and lazertinib showed a partial response in all 20 treatment-naive patients in the initial Chrysalis study. That led to the Mariposa study, where the primary endpoint of PFS was met, it was improved from 60.6 months for patients randomized to osimertinib, which has been the standard of care until now, to 23.7 months of the combination of amivantamab and lazertinib. The study also had a third arm, which was lazertinib alone, and the median PFS was 18 months, so similar to osimertinib. The combination was approved by the FDA in August 2024, and there is a press release from January 7, 3 days ago, showing that the median overall survival was improved with the amylaser compared to osimertinib alone, the MARIPOSA study. The press release indicates improvement of at least 12 months. So it looks like it was a big improvement in overall survival. A new development in the amivantamab is the subcutaneous administration. And there being some studies, the PALOMA, which is a phase one, PALOMA 2, and now in the PALOMA 3, there was a comparison between subcutaneous and intravenous amivantamab. And there were similar pharmacokinetics. The PFS was just about the same, but the overall survival was improved with subcutaneous amivantamab, which was somewhat surprising, but a welcome addition. Obviously, with subcutaneous amivantamab, there's less infusion reactions, and there was a decreased risk for deep vein thrombosis. We have a study that we actually have here, which is called Copernicus. It's a phase two cohort study where patients receive subcutaneous amivantamab with either lazertinib or chemotherapy with carboplatin plus pemetrexed. Now, the results are great. The responses are promising, but the administration is not so easy, and there are issues that need to be taken into account. Dose reduction, prophylactic treatment, and treatment for the complications. So with that, I will give it to Janelle, our great pharmacist, to talk about issues on the administration of amivantamab.
Thanks, Dr. Morgenstern. I would highlight that really it's great to have a interdisciplinary team working to care for these patients and recognizing the data is looking promising, but definitely highlighted well by Dr. Morgenstern is the actual administration and some of the dosing considerations for this product are things you have to discuss with patients and as well your nursing colleagues and infusion nurses. So just for awareness, amivantamab currently is FDA approved as an intravenous infusion, and it does come with some unique dosing considerations. So first, you have to ask yourself if you're giving it as single agent or in combination with other products. To highlight in the combination with lazertinib, amivantamab is dosed first by assessment of the patient's baseline weight. So if they are less than 80 kilograms, week one dosing includes what is a 350 milligram flat dose IV administration on day one, followed by day two, a 700 milligram administered dose. And that is standard for our less than 80 kilogram patient population, as well as you're going to hear for our additional dosing combinations with chemo that we do this day one, day two split dose strategy. Looking at general administration, we typically require patients to come to our infusion center and bring a caregiver with them due to the fact that very often we require additional pre-medications that can cause some sedation with use of antihistamines such as diphenhydramine, which is required for all doses of amivantamab. So we traditionally do either IV or oral, 15 to 30 minutes if it's IV, or 30 to 60 minutes if it's oral of diphenhydramine, followed with an antipyretic with acetaminophen, additionally given with all doses of amivantamab. And then unique for the first week, day one and day two, the administration of dexamethasone. So dexamethasone is given IV 45 to 60 minutes prior to your amivantamab infusion. And that is conditional then moving forward in our treatment based upon how the patient does that very first day or first week of drug administration. So we made it through that very first week. To highlight, this drug does require continual dosing on a weekly basis, really loading up those receptors. So they're traditionally coming in on a weekly basis for week two through four. Back to our combination with lazertinib, the dose we're aiming for is 1,050 milligrams IV weekly. After they get through those first loading weeks, we come back and follow it with a every 2 week dosing strategy for patients so they're not having to come in as frequently. I highlight the dose here because if we had a patient that was over 80 kilograms, we're really targeting a different dose for that weekly and subsequent every 2 week dosing strategy. So if they're greater than 80 kilograms, our aimed dose is 1400 milligrams IV. So recognizing you do need to assess your patient's baseline weight, as well as recognize that your infusion nurses and pharmacists are familiar with what that dosing strategy should look like. To make things a little bit more interesting, when you add it with chemotherapy, they did some adjustments with how the med would be administered to align with that chemotherapy administration of an every 3 week dosing strategy. And with that, I would like to highlight that traditionally, when dosing the three medications together, pemetrexed, carboplatin, and amivantamab, we should be starting in that order. So patients come in and receive pemetrexed first, followed by their carboplatin infusion, and subsequently ending with their amivantamab infusion. And that is all outlined in the package insert and is our standard practice. You're going to notice, though, as well, we continue with that split dosing that first week, additionally assessing a patient's baseline weight as it will determine kind of that max dose they ultimately receive. To highlight with the combination amivantamab and chemotherapy, we do notice that there are some additional adjustments that are made when we reach week seven of treatment. So they continue with that condensed model of weekly dosing. But when they get to that week seven, we try to move them to an every 3 week dosing schedule, which means that our max dose for patients that are less than 80 kilograms is 1750 milligrams IV every 3 weeks. In comparison, if they're more than 80 kilograms, we're looking at roughly 2100 milligrams IV every 3 weeks. And so knowing that these patients have what is unique schedules, patient education is really key. Your nursing staff being familiar with the split dosing mechanism, and to highlight that that split dosing really is necessary. These patients very routinely for intravenous administration have infusion-related reactions. And so preparing the patient for those pre-medications as well as what might happen after they start their infusions is going to be key. And recognizing that post that initial infusion, there are toxicities that can present that ultimately lead to additional adjustments in their dosing. So, in segue to kind of managing those toxicities, Mary Ellen Flanagan is an expert in clinic and really brings these toxicities to the forefront for us to discuss. So, happy to have her describe a bit of what she sees on a regular basis for toxicities with amivantamab infusions.
Thanks so much, Janelle. I want to echo what you said about the importance of having an interdisciplinary team, especially, just to touch on infusion-related reactions. I think when I was preparing for this, I re-looked at the data from Chrysalis, and it said 67%, react. And I think in practice, we prepare for a much higher number and prepare our patients that and plan on having a reaction and explaining that the first dose will be split amongst 2 days. So a couple things I want to focus on as far as unique toxicities, because amivantamab is a unique drug with some unique toxicities. First, I'd like to talk about the risk of venous thromboembolism. Cancer itself, we have to remember, is a prothrombotic condition, and then patients may have baseline characteristics coming into this that place them at higher risk. So it's important for us as providers to be attuned to those things, such as like baseline labs, what type of cancer, where the cancer is coming from, and even BMI can be a factor. And then you add in a drug like amivantamab, which has been shown time and time again to cause a risk of thrombus. I think it's important looking at the MARIPOSA trial, 37% of patients in the amivantamab lazertinib arm experienced some grade of thrombus. So we do recommend prophylactic blood thinners the first 4 months for our patients. The next thing I'd like to talk about is the thing that we think about most is skin or cutaneous toxicities. I think Janssen has done a good job of empowering us as providers to manage these toxicities. Here at the university, we do have the blessing of dermatology that specialize in oncology. So we typically have a low threshold to refer. Classically, we like to wait till it's like grade three or so. And I think we're all attuned to managing and working on preventative things. One thing that I think we are all guilty of that I've been trying to work on personally is the importance of just supportive things. A lot of our patients come to us with poor skin practices, and talk educating them about the importance of UV protection, avoiding very hot showers, women avoiding alcohol-based skin products, and now is not the time to get a manicure and pedicure and basic things like that. And then preventative things like using unfragranced moisturizers. I do like to follow the Cocoon trial, which does prophylactic oral antibiotics in the beginning, then kind of de-escalates to topical antibiotic therapy. Some patients feel strongly about that. So I'll kind of have a low threshold. We'll go ahead and start and I'll talk about the importance of supportive things, but then have a pretty low threshold to escalate. Following up from Janelle's talk, a lot of these skin toxicities have been the cause of dose interruptions. And when we look at the data from MARIPOSA, 37% of patients had dose interruptions and 23% of patients had dose reductions related to these cutaneous toxicities. So it certainly is a big issue for patients getting this drug.
Mary Ellen, I was just going to chime in and comment about the dose reductions because it was a discussion we had in clinic about a patient that really had not reached that every 3 week dosing. Really, during that weekly administration, was showing toxicity intolerance of the dermatologic presenting symptoms and had ultimately had a pause in therapy. We were fortunate enough to kind of de-escalate the exacerbation of the skin toxicity. But just recalling, we had some discussion about, our goal was eventually to go to the every 3 week dosing model. And we elected not to, due to the fact that, recognizing this toxicity likely will continue to exacerbate as we had to hold drug. And I think that led to us almost over communicating to every party downstream, like, we are intentionally not moving to that every 3 week standard dose, and instead kind of staying at a lower dose. And that was something that didn't come up frequently, but led to us having a bit of additional education to even the healthcare side of the participation of their care to let them know that that was all intentional.
Certainly, yeah. Skin toxicities and cutaneous toxicities are is an umbrella term, and many things like rash and things can fall underneath it. But I do want to touch on the importance of we see a lot of paronychia in these patients, and I'm oftentimes will grab my patient's hands and look at their nails at baseline, and if they have dry cuticles and they're not taking care of their hands at baseline, that's kind of setting themselves up for failure. So I stress the importance of moisturization, and there is an indication to do chlorhexidine soaks. And I kind of explain it, you soak for 5 minutes, rinse, and then moisturize, and kind of do that, 1 to 2 times a day as kind of a preventative way of preventing the paranychia.
This
At
is
times.
also not the time to bite the nails, right? One thing to take in account is that paronychias could be very painful, even if you don't see much on the exam, a little fissure or anything. So we have to take this seriously. A grade two paronychia looks very good on the table on the manuscript, but the patients don't feel so good on that. So
Certainly, it can
we have been
affect.
very proactive, Mary Ellen, Janelle. This is really affecting the quality of life.
Quality of
And
life,
the
yeah.
chance of this happening is much higher than osimertinib, that's for sure.
I was going to circle back, Mary Ellen, briefly to the comment you shared about prepping them for that first infusion and really the related reports in the clinical trial. We really talk a lot about the trial data, which was hugely helpful for Dr. Morgenstern to just summarize. I always can appreciate getting a chance to have him consolidate that information for me. But recognizing, the real world perspective of we're not kind of able to selectively find the perfect patient to meet the trial, yet they ultimately could benefit from this therapy. And recognizing that the rates of infusion reactions that we observed at our own institution were very different. And so when you look at the grand scheme of the trial presenting to maybe a community site who's interested in giving this as a treatment option, I think we wanted to relay that it's very likely this patient's going to react to the point where all of us sort of look at our clocks and expect, okay, they're probably at their amivantamab infusion at this point in the day. We would expect to get a call, and really just education to all of the nurses that they prep the patient for these types of things to occur, and you know, working collaboratively to walk over and assess the patient, make sure that they're safe after that initial symptom onset of what we deem to be an infusion reaction, and subsequently saying it's okay that we may not finish that infusion that day. There's some degree of debate. Package labeling would offer you could resume at a reduced rate and then continue ahead. And there is often this discussion we have about, do we want to proceed? How significant were their symptoms when it did start to present? But letting patients know it's okay, because many times they're used to seeing how much they're expected to get as an infusion. And if we don't finish it, they think it's impacting their treatment and their cancer management. So that was something I wanted to just share as a tidbit that the three of us have encountered pretty regularly. And very commonly, they may not finish that 350 milligram day one infusion, but then come back the next day and are really ready to go. We additionally assess what symptoms had presented at the time of that reaction, potentially add on or customize their pre-medication strategy on day two. Maybe we're adding some antiemetics due to the fact they had some nausea with that initial reaction. But they tend to do much better day two and do complete that infusion. There is still a reported incidence of infusion reactions with day two, but many are manageable and can proceed with the whole dose. So just something to highlight that I think we all start to look at the time of our clinic and when patients are traveling through the infusion space and expect to have the opportunity to kind of walk the patient through what this all looks like on that first week of treatment.
Yeah, we certainly have the opportunity to educate our patients, show them the data, and reassure them that the first day might be rough, but, you know, looking at the data, there's opportunity and most patients do well moving forward.
It is interesting that in the Midwest and the South, we've seen an increased risk of infusion reactions of cetuximab, which is an anti-EGFR monoclonal antibody. And I have the impression that we're seeing the same thing of amivantamab. For me, I think it's 100% of our patients, Marilyn, correct me if I'm wrong, I think 100% of our patients have infusion reaction on the first day of the split dose, and very few are able to complete the first infusion. But they are aware that the first dose is very small, it will be a split, the next day it will be again, and we should be able to complete that.
Yeah, I agree. And then also, I just want to highlight the importance of having a Janelle, and, you know, that can kind of help look at the data, look at how, you know, certain things, because I know Janelle and I have spoken about adding in Montelukast and different things like that. And it's so wonderful to have a pharmacist that can kind of help triage these things.
So I hope you enjoy our discussion. We have here two experts. Whenever something goes wrong, Marielle goes there to rescue. And whenever I don't know what dose to give, we have Janelle. And also, I think that we are quite excited about the possibility of subcutaneous, because all the side effects are there except for infusion reaction. And this, at least for us, is one of the major problems besides the cutaneous toxicity. Spironica is what bothers me the most. The other side effects, the MET toxicity that we don't talk about, edema and low albumin. Sometimes edema could be very bothersome. Imagine you have swollen hands with paronychia. That's it really affects the quality of life. So when you decide how to treat the patients, we look not only at the survival benefit and response rates, but also the quality of life. just remind the audience that patients they were enrolling to the Mariposa, they did not receive amivantamab as a second line. So imagine patients that receive just osimertinib in front line and they had tumor progression, they can go Mariposa 2 where they'll receive chemotherapy plus amivantamab. So perhaps the idea is to give amivantamab, but not necessarily in the first line setting. And we don't talk also about the FLAURA2 study where patients were randomized to osimertinib alone or in combination of chemotherapy. And the combination had increased PFS, and it looks like the OS will also be improved in chemotherapy plus osimertinib. So now we have basically three main options: osimertinib alone, amivantamab plus lazertinib, or chemotherapy plus osimertinib. And the decisions will be based. They should be based not only on efficacy, but also toxicity and quality of life.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.